Hello and welcome back to Demand and Desire. I'm Jez Frampton, Chief Executive of Interbrand. Going to be looking around the world in terms of the different sectors in which we operate. Everything from airlines to automotives to healthcare to office services, you name it. And the thing that's going to make it really different is that I'm actually going to be the one on the blocks for a change, so to speak. I'm going to be interviewed by my esteemed colleague, Karen Burke.
Hello. Let's start with airlines. And I think the biggest question that everyone has been asking when you look at the airline sector is profitability.
Of course, one of the biggest issues that all the airlines have got to deal with is rising fuel prices. So they've got internal issues, pension schemes and people's contracts, and they're trying to compete with low-cost airlines. And then on the other side of the coin, which of course these two things impact profitability, is the top line. Right. Is travel growing? I think if you looked at it, you know, there's tremendous growth coming out of Asia and the Middle East, and I think that those two areas around the world are really beginning to set our expectations in terms of service, and they're really starting to sort of push it in terms of what the premium expectation is.
Along those lines, if you think about it in the coming year and everything that's really going on out in the world, and our world has really evolved and we're very digital now, can digital help?
Airlines per se are a highly complex mix of experiences, which some of which are controllable, i.e. the experience actually on the airplane itself, and some of which are uncontrollable, what happens within an airport. There's only so much as an airline that you can control in that situation. Where digital can really help is to actually stitch all of those things together. So many of us already have apps which enable us to get our check-in cards or our boarding cards electronically. But the real opportunity, I think, is to actually use these to engage us much more as customers, to build much better understanding of who we are as people and how we travel.
Right. Charging stations while you're sitting at your gate waiting, or lounges that have HDTV.
Perhaps the way forward is for airlines to become more conscious about partnering with other brands. So in that instance, you know, the real reason why Samsung are doing it is because it's an opportunity for them to showcase some of their products in a captive environment. There are a lot of things that we could do to make travel more fun, and to celebrate the fact that, you know, air travel is an exciting thing, and also to make us more comfortable while we're doing it.
Automotive. Let's take a look at that. Mm-hmm. I know that you've been very involved in that lately with the auto show. Mm. Are we going to stagnate? What's happening?
My personal view would be that I think we've seen what almost amounts to more innovation over the last 5 years than we've seen perhaps in the last 50 as far as the automotive sector is concerned. I think there's tremendous things being done, largely because of different drive chains being experimented with, different propulsion systems, and these actually change the box that designers have to play with so that they can create different spaces, and I think that's very exciting. In addition to that are the driver aids that are being developed. Most of the manufacturers have cars that can navigate themselves effectively. The issue, of course, is around safety and insurance and all these kinds of things, and I think, you know, someone's going to have to break from the pack and effectively give us access to the first car that can steer itself. I know there's lots of experiments being done around chaining cars together electronically so that where they're on a highway, they'll follow as a group and they operate as a group of cars, a little bit like a train. I know a number of the manufacturers are looking into ways to try and get people to drive more efficiently and more as a collective rather than an individual, because a lot of the congestion is caused by people trying to move too fast through slow moving traffic. Now, it might not be too ridiculous for in not far too far into the future to be sitting on a highway and playing cards or watching TV.
I think it's exciting. And move the slow people out of the fast lane. What about competition? Because, you know, the industry right now is very difficult. There's a lot of competition. What are they doing? Who's doing it well? And what's happening really between the different regions of the world?
I'm going to be terribly diplomatic and say that I think pretty much all of the major manufacturers from pretty much everywhere in the world are doing exciting things in one way or another at the moment. The car industry, as historically, it's a well-known fact that the industry has been oversupplied for quite some time. The capacity which exists to build vehicles outweighs the demand. I think the real competition now is happening in the emerging markets. I think GM have certainly put themselves back into a position whereby, the only way is down seemed to be the story for them in the future, but certainly their presence at Detroit showed that they are well and truly back. I think the German manufacturers continue to kind of show the way in terms of how to construct consistent brands. None of us should underestimate the power of companies like Nissan, like Toyota, and of course some of the rising stars in Korea like Hyundai. Mm-hmm. So I think everything's up for grabs, which is a fun time.
There's a lot of questions regarding cars that are green, good for the environment, what's good, not good for the environment, who's doing it well, who's really thinking about it, who's not thinking about it yet.
Yeah, I think, this is not an issue just for the car industry. It affects pretty much every industry on the planet. I think as consumers we are all getting a lot more aware of the inputs and outputs of what we do. True sustainability involves looking at the end-to-end life costs of creating any product or service, and most of the businesses, this is a central plank and a central theme of what they do. And many companies, particularly the Japanese companies actually, have been leading the way in this area for quite some time. Toyota have benefited tremendously from the Prius, but then of course you start digging a little deeper and of course you realise that the cost of recycling the vehicles almost negates the value of having a lower fuel consumption car on the road in the first place.
Are we as consumers pushing the automotive industry to do that, or are they taking that upon themselves?
I think it's probably a bit of both. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we are anywhere near the levels of consumer pressure that brands are going to experience over the next 5 or 10 years where sustainability is concerned. Mm-hmm. It's a practice that we've made considerable efforts in developing inside into brand. We think it's an important part of the future for every type of business. The signals are at the moment that it can be a useful offensive strategy, but it's unclear the degree to which it genuinely moves consumer opinion and choice. We've done some studies on it, and it shows that the impact of corporate citizenship on purchase ranges between about 5% and 15%, depending on the sector you're looking at. Not insignificant, but by no means the major driver. The real question is how much that will change into the future. The big risk is that you discover somewhere along the supply chain that you're not as good as you should be, or that something happens along the way. Perhaps BP is a kind of an extreme example, but I think what people want to see is that companies are actively engaged in building strategies in this area and executing against them.
Okay, let's talk about the business services sector and what's happening there. Brands like Cisco and Xerox and other companies, what are they doing? What are they doing well? What's going to make someone actually win in the sector?
I think many of these companies, actually rather like Interbrand, are at their heart professional services businesses. Cisco is a great example of a company that, they have huge technological capabilities, and a large part of what you buy from Cisco is the kit and how it works within your existing infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But on top of that is the service element, which is about the people that you do business with, how they do business with you, how they make it feel, the degree to which they make your lives easier. So I think, there's a big clue in there about the importance of employee behaviour and culture. Certainly the large companies, many of these service businesses have significant elements of outsourcing involved in them as well. So you've got multiple companies working together in order to deliver a solution. A lot of the employees of these businesses spend the vast majority of their working lives actually within their client companies. Mm-hmm. So maintaining a sense of connection, a sense of belonging, a sense of pride for the organisation, and continuing to you know, be able to give clear points of view about how the business is thinking, what its principles, its values are, as well as selling messages, are important things to keep people engaged, keep them focused, and keep them, you know, singing up the benefits of your brand, which is, you know, at large part, differentiation of business-to-business brands is as much to do with the individuals that you interact with as it is the brand itself.
Absolutely.
The brand itself might, you know, the name of a company like Xerox, you know, gets you on the pitch list, so
right.
to speak.
Right.
What keeps you as a client is the relationships and the passion of the employees that do business with you. We often talk about the fact that you can never be a great brand on the outside until you are a great brand on the inside.
Right.
Any company which has a significant people element to its delivery, and any business which is a business-to-business company has that as a fundamental driver. Getting it right in terms of culture, leveraging your employee behaviours and how they deliver your brand are absolutely critical to creating any sense of differentiation.
And how are they going to do that? Because so many of them are cutting their budgets.
It's a tough one, yeah. Because, you know, on one hand, you want to try and make sure that you deliver a better service. Your service is delivered by people, but your people are disgruntled because you're taking their friends out as you reduce the size of your workforce.
Right.
You know, I mean, this for me, again, reinforces the need for investment in that area because, of course, you know, the reasons why companies should be resizing or focusing their activities is because they believe that it will somehow make their business stronger and more resilient. The net result of that to the people that remain within the business is that they should have greater job security going forward, and that, you know, there needs to be some kind of reinforcement by the business of the importance of the people in becoming successful or more successful into the future. When you rely a lot upon the morale of a large group of employees to deliver your brand, you know, you really, really have to focus carefully on making sure that they understand what you stand for, so that there's a real sense of pride that runs through everything they do. I think great professional services firms and business services firms understand this and deliver very well.
Let's take a look at what's going on digitally in that world. How is that changing how people are buying?
I remember back in the dot-com days, everyone was saying that we were all going to become perfect economic consumers because we would have complete information,
right.
And we wouldn't need brands anymore,
right?
Because we'd just make choices based on perfect information. The truth is that kind of somehow ignores the fact that we're all human beings and that we have hearts as well as heads. So one of the big challenges for brands going forward is to understand the fact that you know, data is almost perfect now. You can, at the touch of a button, find out, you know, 15 different places within a short walk that sell the same product for less money, which puts a tremendous amount of pressure on retailers. The patience that we have with brands is changing quite significantly. My personal experience of buying a fridge freezer recently is that, you know, the store that I tried to buy it from in the UK told me that it would take them a week to determine whether they would live up to their price match guarantee. By the time the assistant had gone to get the forms for me to fill out, I'd already bought the product online.
How does that play in? Right now, with the economy being what it is, I think for the first time when we've seen recessions, if you want to use that word, right, typically consumers trade down.
Yeah.
But what's been happening over the last several years, and as we're in this time, we're seeing consumers be very selective about what they do trade down, and do they have to? Can they get online, do a price check, and get a better price? How do you see the digital piece playing into that, the economy, and the buying habits?
I think in some instances, you know, we all make decisions about the products and services that we buy on a weekly, monthly, or yearly basis, and we have the relative degree of, I suppose, consideration that we take in deciding what we're going to buy will have a big effect on the amount of time we might spend making that decision. So I think some of it has to do with the relative cost, you know. So buying a packet of gum has a different set of considerations going to it than buying a car. More than that, though, I mean, looking into the future, I think it's going to change the way that people's relationships with brands change in terms of loyalty. You know, it's much easier to make those price quality equations now by picking on what other people are saying and the experiences that they're having. One of the things that we talk about is that there's always somebody a step ahead of you in the buying process. trading up or trading down really comes down to a perception of value, and value is based upon how much you pay for something and what you think you're going to get in return. In difficult economic times, it forces stronger value-based decisions. I don't think it necessarily forces price decisions. So in a lot of instances, you see people trading up.
Right.
So actually, the luxury brands have done pretty well over the last three or four years, because I think the people believe that maybe if I do spend a few, you know, few more dollars on a bag from Gucci, it might last a little bit longer. And it won't go out of fashion, and it might actually be a better investment in the long term. And I think, you know, what you're seeing there is that you're not, you're seeing partially a flight to quality, and you're seeing really, really what you're seeing is value-based decisions.
Let's turn to fast developing markets. There seems to be a lot of things happening in them and around them and coming out of them. With the economy and everything that's going on, is that going to slow down?
You know, even the Chinese are spooked by the fact that they're going to have less than 10% growth this year. The Indians seem convinced that they're going to continue to grow at an alarming rate. The Brazilians have had a fantastic couple of years, and now, of course, increasingly we hear about South Africa. You know, so it's no longer brick, it's bricks. Their fortunes are partially tied to what's going on in the rest of the world. But as everybody knows, even within China, you know, the sheer size of their emerging consumer population means that they can continue to command growth levels of 5% plus just by serving the needs of their internal market. It's not quite that simple, though, of course, because at the same time as their market is growing, more and more competitors are coming into the market to compete against the homegrown, shall we say, brands.
Is that is going to continue, some of the growth?
Oh, my goodness. Who knows what's going to happen in the global economy? Certainly, talking to people I know within the financial industry, the volatility in markets in Europe is reducing. That would suggest that perhaps the markets believe that it's a bit more stable than it was at the end of last year. China is tempering its expectations. I'm a great believer in you get what you hope for. And I think actually for a large part of 2011, people were hoping for a bad 2012. And to a degree, you know, they say expectations drive reality. So companies, you know, downgrade their budgets, they downgrade their expectations, they reset their workforces and their production schedules in order to meet what they believe demand will be, and consequently they kind of get what they believe in terms of what shows up. You make your own future, shall we say. My personal belief is that in all of the developing markets, there is still tremendous opportunity for growth just in their own domestic markets. So whilst they might be affected by what's going on in the Western world, North America, etc., I think most of them have got more than enough to do just by sort of like, you know, developing their own consumer markets internally.
As companies are growing inside their own countries in these markets, what are the expectations that consumers have of those companies? Because here in the US and then abroad over in Europe, there's a lot about being good citizens, good corporate citizens. Is that pressure, is that expectation starting to play out in the developing markets?
From a consumer sense, I would say probably no. In a lot of the markets, what you see is very, very high levels of desire to get their hands on luxury brands, for, you know, foreign brands, international brands, whatever it might be.
Name brands.
And, you know, regardless of, you know, the brands that they might be trying to get associated with or to own, I think there's just this kind of battle for standard of living, which is that, you know, in many of the sort of tier three, tier four cities in China, you know, they're going for a consumer boom, really. The opportunity to have good quality, you know, TVs, hi-fis, etc., etc., in your home. So these are like rites of passage, as almost as far as we're concerned. I think a lot of the businesses, however, are thinking seriously about the future, and I've certainly had many conversations myself with leading businessmen, specifically actually in China and Brazil, saying that their hope is that they wish to sort of leapfrog or step ahead of the of North America and Western Europe in terms of being seen to be good corporate citizens. So I think they see we don't have the legacy issues in place. They know they've got some dirty power stations or whatever it might be, but they, you know, let's learn from what everyone else is doing and do something much better.
And battling with other brands from outside?
Yes, just take China, for example. You know, everyone and anyone is in there right now trying to take advantage of this growth. It's exciting, it's dynamic, and there's a lot happening. However, if you're a Chinese native brand, all of a sudden there's an onslaught of global competition. You know, I think the smart, and there's a lot of very, very smart Chinese companies, are learning extremely quickly and are, shall we say, turning the branding and marketing skills of the Western world back on it. And if it took the Japanese 20 years to work out what we were up to, and the Taiwanese 10 years, and the Koreans 5, I think the Chinese are kind of almost ahead already.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll be long, for instance, before we see a Chinese brand on our best global brands list, which would be fantastic, because I think everyone will suddenly sort of step back and go, ooh, what was that?